Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Richard Kirsch, an old friend, an institute fellow at the Nelson Rockefeller Institute of Government, and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Kirsch is the author of Fighting for Our Health, the epic battle to make health care a right in the United States. Kirsch served as National Campaign Manager for Healthcare for America Now from 2008 to 2010, after spending more than two decades as Executive Director of Citizen Action of New York. Richard Kirsch, thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you for doing this, Alan. It's really great. As a long-time, I think, lifetime member of the station, it's great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit, Richard, about you. We know you. We know your wonderful wife, Claudia. What makes you go?
What makes me go? More than anything else, I'm just angry at economic injustice. I'm angry that we have a country that has such extraordinary wealth and that we still have so many people who can't share in it. We have not only record levels of poverty, but nowadays, even the middle class is getting crushed. People worry that they can't educate their kids, they can't retire in safety. And so to have such incredible wealth in this country and not find a way to have shared prosperity, that gets me angry. It's not just, oh, it's unfair. It gets me really angry. And that's what keeps me going. That's what's kept me going my whole life.
Now, you went to a prestigious university. You could have gone right. You went to business school. You could have gone right. But it just seemed to reinforce your interest in equality. And I want to talk to you about that equality when you get a chance.
Yes, it did. And, you know, healthcare is the most extraordinary example of it. Because we spend, as you know, I think most of your listeners know, we spend twice as much in healthcare than any other country. And yet we leave now, with the recession, 50 million people without any insurance. 60% of bankruptcies have to do with medical costs. So we have all this wealth, and yet we're still bankrupting people, not covering them. So healthcare, I think, has become my central passion because health is so important. I mean, you do these medical shows all the time. It's you know in your gut how important it is, and people feel that. And yet to not be able to afford it, to worry about going to the doctor, well, you can't afford that, or you might go bankrupt if you're seriously ill. That's so unfair with such wealth and such an incredible medical system. So that really gets me going, gets me angry, and it's keeps me motivated.
I recently had a tooth implant. Now, I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that by the time this is done, it's going to cost me for one tooth $7,000.
Oh, my God.
By the time it's all over, everything included, that's what it'll cost. And I turned around to several dentists and I said to them, what about poor people? Shrug.
Dentists are the worst that way. Actually, I mean, one of the big holes in our healthcare system is dental care. And dental care is really important to your health care.
Oh, yeah.
People who have poor dental care suffer from a lot worse health. And also, if your teeth aren't good, you're not going to find a job. So dental care is another huge hole in our healthcare system that somehow we ignore. Not true in the rest of the world. Dental care is thought of the same way as healthcare. There's no distinction. It's part of your body.
So let's get to it. Barack Obama is about to run another time. I've been with a lot of top Democrats lately who've said to me, it's going to be a real battle. I was with Governor Patrick the other day in Massachusetts who said, you know, part of his record has to be that he has provided all of this health care to people. And of course, you were in on that campaign big time and directed a good part of the grassroots action that went to getting it passed. And yet, it is the Rush Limbaughs and the other guys, they have painted this as a disgrace rather than as an asset. How did that happen, and why do so many people believe it?
Well, it's very easy to scare people. And as we were just saying, healthcare is so, so important to you that this fear of losing what you have becomes crushing. We always knew in planning the campaign that the other side would use fear. We actually had to use anger against the insurance industry because the only way you could fight fear is with anger. No one ever said, I'm scared as hell, I won't take it anymore. And so you have to motivate anger. But they use fear, and they particularly use fear with seniors. And in really the biggest travesty of all, they created this myth started by Betsy McCoy, a former New Yorker, unfortunately, that there were these death penalties just for Medicare saying we're willing to pay your doctor to talk to you about what's the best way to prepare as you get seriously ill in your old age. They scared seniors by saying Medicare was going to be cut when actually they were trimming some waste and actually expanding Medicare benefits. So for the first time under the Affordable Care Act, there's free preventive care.
Stop for a second. Everybody has to understand that the Affordable Care Act is what the Republicans call Obamacare.
And, you know, we're calling it Obamacare, too, because we sure. should be proud of it.
Sure.
I mean, you started by saying in the presidential debate, you know what, and Mitt Romney's going to be the nominee when all this is
sure.
done.
Agreed.
And what the president should really be saying to Mitt is, Mitt, you should be proud of Romney Care. 95% of people in Massachusetts are covered. 99.5% of children in Massachusetts are covered. Healthcare costs are going down. Fewer people go to the emergency room. Insurance companies aren't able to charge as much as they did. Hospitals and doctors are being forced to control costs. You should be proud of this. This is an extraordinary accomplishment. And the only reason you're not is because you're so worried about the crazy right wing.
What is Mitt Romney saying now about Romney Care?
Well, he's can't say anything, so he says both things. He says it was the right thing to do in Massachusetts. In fact, he gave a great defense when he was on the campaign trail down south for the individual mandate. But he says, oh, but it's not
let's,
a good
let's
model.
Let's make sure actually. We give everybody the right. The individual mandate means everybody has to have health care coverage.
Unless it's not affordable. And that's one thing we tend to leave out of this. So basically what the law in Massachusetts, what Romney Care did as a model, and it's working very well, and what Obamacare does, it says you have to purchase coverage, but unless it's deemed not affordable. The other thing, which is really important to understand, because people would say, how can I afford health coverage? But you're not going to simply have to purchase coverage like you do now with no help. If you don't get health care at work and you make too much for Medicaid, you're going to be able to buy coverage through these new health care marketplaces called exchanges. And the amount you pay will depend on your income. You'll get subsidies from the government, so you'll only have to pay so much based on your income. And so it's not like a mandate just to go out now in the market to buy health insurance, which would cripple people. It's actually a whole new system where you'll go out. And if you don't get coverage at work, you don't qualify for Medicaid, you'll have a new market regulated. In Massachusetts, they do a great job of controlling costs of the premiums. You'll get a lot of subsidies from the government. And then if the subsidies aren't enough, you can't afford it, you won't be required to buy it.
Now, Richard Kirsch, in your book, which I recommend to people, Fighting for Our Health, you do a very good service for all of us. You go through the history of attempts to provide health care for the American people. A lot of people don't know that Harry Truman, who looks better and better and better in history, really had a full-scale push to have health care for everybody in the United States. You go through, in a very good fashion, the Obama-Clinton fight for the presidency and go through what their various plans were. And you remind us what went wrong when Mrs. Clinton, then Senator, now Secretary of State Clinton, and Bill Clinton tried to do in terms of setting up what could only be called a Rube Goldberg arrangement where this was buying from that and this was giving to that. Americans just threw up their heads and said, we don't understand, we don't like it. Along comes Obama, president, and he comes up with something else. But I'm a little afraid that when you start talking about these healthcare exchanges, even that's a little too complicated for most people to understand. You want to go into that?
Well, you're right. Right now, when it's not in place, it's hard to understand. And you asked before, where is the public on this legislation? It's not nearly as bad as the right would make you think. So let's look at one of the latest tracking polls from Kaiser, which Kaiser Family Foundation every month asks people about where they stand on Obamacare. Interestingly enough, 31% say it doesn't go far enough, and 18% say that they want to keep it. So that's about half, which is more than the people who want to repeal it or repeal and replace it. That 31% is because, really, for most people, the law didn't take effect yet. It's not till 2014 that the big thing this law is going to do that's really going to help people take effect. And that's when, if you don't get health coverage at work, if you'll be able to get coverage. If you lose your job, you'll be able to get coverage. If you're sick and you want to buy coverage, you won't have to worry about pre-existing conditions. That's when the law takes effect in 2014. And then the exchanges won't be a mystery. In Massachusetts now, they're not a mystery. People simply go, and if they don't get coverage at work, they apply, they fill out an application. It's pretty straightforward. My daughter did it. She moved to Massachusetts a few years ago. She was not making a lot of money. She was a nanny. She applied. She got affordable health coverage. And as a father, that was huge. She has a chronic condition, has to take medication. It was extraordinary, and it was very simple. So why the Republicans are so desperate to kill it now is they know that if we get to 2014 and it takes effect, it's going to be incredibly popular, like it is in Massachusetts. People are going to see this huge worry they have in their lives. Can I afford my health coverage? Can I switch my job? What happens if I lose my job? Can I retire early? That worry is going to disappear, and it's going to be because of a new government program. That is the Republicans' biggest nightmare.
So, as we speak, the force, the anti, if you want to use this term, Obamacare, are massing to go to the Supreme Court of the United States and try to get the guts of the bill ripped out. I wonder if you'd talk about that a bit.
Right. Well, so the big challenge is to this requirement that everyone be required to have coverage unless, as I said, you can't afford it. And there's been a that's been the center of the challenge in court against the act. And if you had asked me a few months ago, I would have said Supreme Court, because it's so political and it's so conservative, and we saw in Citizens United, it doesn't give a hoot about settled law, I would have said the court is going to overturn this individual mandate. But you know what?
Let's go through that one more time, Richard, right, just so everybody gets it. The individual mandate is?
It's a requirement that if you don't get coverage at work and you make too much for Medicaid, you then will have to get coverage on your own. But not really on your own. You'll have to get coverage from these new healthcare marketplaces where you'll get government subsidies. But you'll have to get coverage unless you can't afford it. It's a little bit complicated, but the basic idea is that you'll have to get coverage unless you can't afford it. And if you can't afford it, then you won't be required to get coverage.
And those who are opposed to this are making the constitutional argument that you can't force people to buy something. Isn't that right?
Right.
How's that answered?
Well, the interesting thing is, and this is what gives me encouragement, two very, very conservative jurists appointed by Reagan and Bush. One was a clerk with Scalia, the very conservative Supreme Court justice, have ruled in favor of Congress being able to pass legislation that says you have to buy health insurance. And the reason they've done that, they've said two things. First of all, the Commerce Clause says that the government can regulate interstate commerce. And they said healthcare is a product and not buying it is an activity. Because what happens if you don't buy it? It's not like when you get sick, we're going to leave you alone. If you don't have it, you go to the emergency room, we're going to take care of you. And because of that, it's an economic activity that affects other people. And so this one conservative jurist said that works with the Commerce Clause. Another conservative jurist says, yes, there's a balance between Congress's ability to deal with fundamental problems and individual liberty. In this case, Congress exercised their judgment well because they said health care is something which we all need, we all have to get, it costs us all, and so it can be a regulated economic activity. So obviously we don't know. It's very political. But it's starting to look like we're not going to see a straight right-wing, left-wing decision from this court. We may well see the court uphold the law.
Well, you certainly could be right. We may. On the other hand, we have watched this 5-4 majority of what I would only call the blue meanies, you know, just do what's the Republican thing, from calling elections to, I can't even imagine Clarence Thomas buying what you just said or Scalia buying what you've said. So, you know, maybe you get a guy like Kennedy who has been on the fence sometime, but not that often, coming over to the other side and defending the program. The Republicans are doing their best. But in the meantime, the American people have sort of had enough, haven't they, with health care being provided to some but not to everyone? Because as you point out in your book, most Americans realize that health care in America is really not that bad. In other words, you've made the point that a lot of people are happy with their health care. Obama comes along and puts 40-something million people onto the rolls. Many of those people are the poorest people in our society, the people you've been fighting for, Richard Kirsch, all of your life. But the guys, some of the people, the middle class in the trailers and in some of the small houses on Long Island say, what's in it for me? And they don't feel there's been that much given to them. I think that may have been a bad move on the part of those people putting, including you, who've done so much to put this thing together.
We actually do a lot for those folks. And this is one of the things, again, that people won't see. First of all, a lot of most of the people who are going to be newly covered are not the poorest, because they've all already been eligible for Medicaid. So we're going to take Medicaid, which in a lot of states is well below the poverty level, and bring it up above the poverty level all around the country. So a lot of working poor will get covered. But let's deal with the middle class. A lot of those middle class folks don't get coverage at work. Some of them work two or three jobs, or they have their own small business. They're now going to be able to get affordable coverage. But what's even less understood is that most people will still get coverage at work. They're already being helped. Up till the time that Obamacare passed, your insurance company could say, if you get seriously ill, let's say you get cancer and you spend a couple hundred thousand dollars, we're going to stop paying.
Yep.
That's not true anymore. Right now, your coverage at work has to cover your annual, there's no annual caps and there'll be no lifetime caps. So you're basically having a system where a lot more people are going to, even people who get coverage now at work, their coverage is being improved. And then you've got several million people like my daughter, who's 25, who's covered under our policy, which wasn't true before. And you have all these seniors who have been complaining for years about the donut hole, which is the thing where you have to pay your prescription drug coverage, but they don't pay for your drugs anymore. That's being closed. It's going to be closed entirely. So the law actually does help lots and lots of middle-class working people. A lot of times they don't see it, but when they will see it, clearly, is in 2014, assuming we get there, assuming we get past the Supreme Court, assuming we get past this presidential election, they'll see it.
There's so many directions I want to go with you, Richard Kirsch, but I want to remind everybody that we're talking to Richard Kirsch. His book is Fighting for Our Health, Healthcare for America. The subtitle is The Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. Well, Richard, of course, as a loyal listener to WAMC, you know that we've had an awful lot of people on this station who've talked about how Obama sold out and didn't go for universal health care, Medicare for all. I know that this is the inside story of your book, of how that happened. Fascinating read. But how did it, in shorthand, happen that that was jettisoned?
Well, what people don't understand is that there's a huge amount of fantasy in the idea that if you actually had put out the idea that Medicare for all or single payer, that that would be popular. Now, I've been through this. In 1993, 1994, actually starting in 1986, I was very active in the last big fight for health care for all, and that culminated in the defeat of the Clinton plan. And I was a big champion of, although I didn't call it single payer, it was single payer because people don't know what single payer is. There's a great cartoon that says, is that the single prayer plan? But what happens is you scare people deeply when you say that you have to give up your insurance for government-run health insurance. And single-payer champions say, though there's a poll that shows it's popular. Polls are totally beside the point. You can ask a question one way and get it to be popular. Ask it another way, it's unpopular. The reality is what single-payer and Medicare for all is, give up your health insurance you've got now for government-run health insurance. People are scared of change, we talked about. People are frightened about change when it comes to health care. And to say you have to give up what you have for government-run health care, which is what it would be, government health insurance, when people are so dubious about the government. So we didn't want to go through that again. We didn't want to lose. We knew we had to have an approach that dealt with the fundamental problem that the public could support. And that's where the genesis is. I came up on my own, and then a guy named Jacob Hacker, who's a professor at Yale, came up independently for what became known as the public option, where you said to people, you can keep what you have if you like it, but if it's private insurance, we're going to regulate it to make it better, or we're going to give you the choice of a public health insurance option so you're not at the mercy of the private health insurance companies. And the interesting thing about that is what people liked was choice. The public part, actually, they weren't so sure about because they thought public insurance was going to be not so good. It's for poor people, but they wanted it there in case they lost their insurance. But people loved choice. And yes, the insurance companies attacked it and attacked it and attacked it. It didn't matter. It stayed popular. It stayed popular till their guy, Joe Lieberman, killed it at the end.
Don't even get me started on Lieberman. Okay, so I guess what I want to ask you is this. Medicare works for our parents. Frankly, I'm 70 years old and it's working just fine for me. There are a lot of people who thought, yay, every year you lower it 1 year and pretty soon everybody is covered. It's a system that works. Why couldn't there have been Medicare for all?
Well, doing it the way you just talked about, lowering it, is what Joe Lieberman killed. So we wanted to cover everyone. And see, if he'd simply said we're going to lower Medicare a year at a time and we'd be able to do that, you wouldn't have covered everyone. You would have still left most of the 50 million people uninsured without insurance.
Remind me who those 50 million people were. They were not the people on Medicaid, you say. So who were they?
They're people who are small business people, people who work at low-wage jobs that don't provide health coverage. People may have retired early. They're people who've just lost their jobs. They're people who don't get coverage at work and make too much for Medicaid. And there's 50 million in the country right now.
Isn't all of this a matter of perception? And if people don't perceive that it was, I've often wondered why somebody comes running out of their trailer or small house and yells, it's socialism, I tell you, it's socialism, when they're the beneficiaries. I can't get that.
People get scared. I mean, the most ludicrous are all these seniors at Tea Party events who said, keep the government out of my Medicare. And one of the problems is they don't even realize that Medicare is a government program. And that's something that I actually fault progressives for. We should say Medicare is our national health insurance program for seniors and people with disabilities. We should make people understand that. But we haven't done that. And so people can...
Who's the we here?
Well, we, I think, in this case, are generally those people who support Medicare, think government's important, Democrats who believe that. Basically, the whole community of people who think government has can play a positive role. Government is contested ground. You know, people say government's too big, too little. That's not the point. The question is whether the government works for the 99% or the 1% in current language, where the government is benefiting most people. It's contested ground. And we have to make it clear that when government does well, like provides national health insurance through Medicare for seniors, it's doing a good job. And as you say, I have a very, very conservative father-in-law. He still loves Medicare. So
yeah,
don't touch my Medicare. Right. That's very, very important. On the other hand, don't touch my Medicare. One of the problems, actually, this is ironic, but this is something that you know, Celinda Lake, who's a great progressive pollster. We were talking about Medicare for All. She said, believe it or not, that will scare seniors. They're so worried about their own Medicare that the worry, if you start extending it to other people, it'll harm it. So we wanted to cover everyone. At the end, though, Howard Dean was really, really pushing to try to get Medicare dropped from age 55 to from 65 to 55 just as a buy-in, as a transition for people. And that was going to pass, except as a chapter in my book called Lieberman's Revenge. And it's Lieberman's Revenge because Lieberman was so angry at progressives for defeating him in the Democratic primary in 2006 that even though he'd supported lowering the Medicare age when he ran for president, he'd said he supported it 3 months before he killed it. Once he heard that progressives liked it, he killed it just to get back at progressives. He's that mean a guy. And the fact he's retiring from the Senate, good riddance. It's like, should have happened a long time ago. Unfortunately, it didn't happen in 2006.
So Richard Kirsch, again, fighting for our health, the epic battle to make health care a right in the United States. What happened to that public option?
Well, it got killed in two ways. First of all, the president... Barack Obama plays a very mixed role.
Let me stop you there.
Sure.
Let me go back a little bit. Remind everybody one more time what the public option was.
Sure. So the public option was basically an option for people to buy either private insurance in these new healthcare marketplaces or to have a new plan that would be organized nationally as a public health insurance plan, kind of like a Medicare plan, only for people who are under the Medicare age. And so if you didn't get coverage at work and you were going to buy health coverage through one of these new marketplaces, you could choose from several regulated private insurance plans, newly regulated, or you'd have a choice of a national public health insurance plan. And what the Congressional Budget Office said, that would be less expensive because it would pay doctors and hospitals less, close to what Medicare does, using its purchasing power to lower costs. It wouldn't have the high profits and administrative costs that private insurance has. It also wouldn't be structured to make a buck in another way, which is I'm going to turn down your care because it's going to cost me money. And so this public option, people thought, and as the president said on his good days, it will lower costs and keep the health insurance companies honest. That was exactly our argument. On his bad days, he said that and said, but I'm willing to give it away. And so what happened to the public option? One of the problems is the president was willing on his bad days to give it away. And those are always the same days as his good days. And I tell a story in the book. In September of 2009, the president this is after the Tea Party August and healthcare is attacked. He gives this big speech in front of Congress, both houses of Congress, talking about the healthcare plan, why it has to happen. Very eloquent, powerful speech. Then he gives this great defense of why we need a public option. And after that, he says, but I'm willing to compromise it away. And I won't go into the details, but I'm willing to compromise it away. Literally 30 seconds after the president finishes, I get a call on my phone in my apartment in Washington, D.C. from Robert Pair, who's the dean of the healthcare reporter, works for the New York Times, great reporter. And he says, didn't the president just give the whole store away? And I had to say no, because the truth is the president had been doing that all along. So I give an honest answer to Robert Pair. I said, he didn't say anything he hasn't said before. The reality was Robert Pair was almost right. He was trying to give it away. We still kept it going, though. One of the reasons we kept it going, surprisingly, was Chuck Schumer. Chuck Schumer, who usually doesn't do this, he usually tries to stick pretty much in the middle, he became a huge defender of the public option. He really fought for it hard in the Senate Finance Committee. He kept fighting for it hard.
Was that because of Blue State New York?
Because of Blue State New York, because he was running for election, re-election. He wanted to protect his left flank against all the people in New York who really want single payer. And another thing, though, Chuck is very, very smart in terms of the public.
Incredible.
He understood that the public option was something, as we understood, that had a tremendous appeal to everybody. It wasn't just a left thing. And so he could do two things with this. He could come up with something that made great sense from health policy, that was broadly popular, and protected his left flank in New York.
Interesting. So what did happen to the public option?
So what finally happened is, well, first of all, we got Harry Reid to keep it in his bill, which was huge. And then it was the last big issue other than abortion in the Senate. And Harry Reid put together a group of conservative Democrats and liberal Democrats. And remember, they had to get all 60 votes because not a single Republican would do it. And so he put together these in the room. And at the end, they couldn't get Ben Nelson from Nebraska and Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas to go with the public option. But we could get them to go with this compromise, which was to lower to allow people to get into Medicare if they're only 55 years old. They'd have to pay for it, but it'd be better than private insurance. And this was, we saw, at least as a big advance, because even if we couldn't get a public option for everyone, at least we could get Medicare to a lower age, which in the long run could lead to Medicare covering everyone, which we'd love to see.
Sure.
But one person refused to go to that negotiation session, even though he'd been asked, and that was Joe Lieberman. Still, they thought he's going to go for this. 3 months beforehand, he told editors at the Hartford Courant, I'm for this. But as I said before, once he heard it, it was Lieberman's revenge. The progressives like it, I'm going to kill it. The insurance companies didn't like it either, and Joe Lieberman always did what the insurance companies wanted.
So people should remember that you were really one of the great generals in all of this. You were pushing the pieces. You were in the guts of the whole thing. You had left your long position at Citizens Action New York in order to go down there and to marshal the forces and to do all of this. Did you end up a little angry with the president for having sacrificed the public option?
Yes. You know, it's important to understand the president in a full way. I was angry at him for not defending the public option, for fighting for it. I was angry at him and Harry Reid for not just totally coming down on Joe Lieberman at the end. On the other hand, if there's a hero in this story, it is Barack Obama. Before he was elected president, his staff, campaign staff, said, don't push health care. He says, I'm going to push health care. He said to himself the night he was elected, before he gave his big acceptance speech in Grand Park, what do I most want to do? He says, if I can be sure that everybody in this country has health care, that's a big accomplishment. Three times in his presidency, his top staff said, don't do it. Right after he was elected, when the economic crisis, they said, give it up. And twice, once in the summer of 2009 and once after Scott Brown took Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts, Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, said, don't do it. Just push for kitty care. And Obama said, no. I want legislation that has the ability to cover everyone in this country. And so the president is a very interesting guy. He always wants to compromise. He always wants middle ground to a fault, as we've seen in so many ways. But still, he has some core principles. And in healthcare, he fought hard and won legislation that when implemented in 2014, will mean that everyone in this country, almost everyone, 95% of people will have a guarantee of good health care they can afford.
From the Department of What If, Richard Kirsch, what if Hillary Clinton had won the nomination, won the presidency? Could you project yourself, maybe a silly question, into how different things might have been one way or the other?
You know, Alan, I don't think there's any way to know. They had very similar health care plans. Would Hillary have compromised as much as the President Obama? I don't know. Would she have stuck at the end and fought as hard? I don't know. I just think it's speculation. We have no way of knowing. We have what we have. But the thing also I'd like to be sure we talk about is the grassroots campaign, because what we did in Healthcare for America Now, and what I love most talking about in fighting for our health, is how average people really were the heroes. It's very easy to be cynical about the huge power that huge corporate interests have in this country. But we had, in this campaign, average people who, by telling their stories to members of the U.S. Senate and members of Congress, took healthcare supporters, Democrats who were supporters, and we made them champions who didn't give up. And we took conservative Democrats who probably would have voted against the legislation, but when they had a look in the eyes of their constituents who were uninsured and hear their stories, they voted for the legislation. And for me, as someone who spent his whole life organizing ordinary people to lift their voices, to do that in a strategic way on such a historic issue, it really is moving to see that. And, you know, one story we should probably talk about is Marcellus Owens. Now, if people look at the picture of President Obama signing the Health Care Act into law, to his right, there's this very cute 11-year-old black kid wearing a white shirt and a blue tie that matches the president and a nice vest. What was Marcellus Owens doing next to the president? Now, the shortcut for historians will be his mother died because she didn't have health insurance. That's true. But the real story is Marcellus Owens' grandmother was canvassed by a community organizer working for a group called Washington Community Action Network. That's how she became active. Her daughter, Tiffany, testified at the Washington State Legislature about the fact that she didn't have health insurance because she worked for Jack in the Box. And even though she worked hard there, it wouldn't give her insurance. She actually got insurance, and then when she got really sick, Jack in the Box fired her because she was missing so much time. When she died because she didn't have insurance, her son said, I want to follow my mother's example and my grandmother's example. I want to be a healthcare activist. There was this huge rally in Washington State where Senator Patty Murray, who's the fourth-ranking senator, was at this rally. 5,000 people were there. It took a lot. I tell in the story of the book, in the book, how hard it was to get her there. And behind the stage, she met Marcellus Owens. And there's a picture on my website. You can see Senator Patty Murray taking the hand of Marcellus Owens as he says to her, I'm here because I don't want anyone to die like my mother did. And from there, Marcellus Owens got invited to Washington, where he spoke at a press conference with Harry Reid. He was attacked by Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck. He just shrugged it off. And at the end, the president invited him to stand next to him. And he was the same color tie because they were rushing off to Washington from Seattle. He forgot his tie. And when he got there, the woman at the White House said, what color tie would you like? He said, I don't care. And she got on the same one as the president's. And he's a cute kid. He saw the president just before the speech. And he said to the president, I like the color of your tie.
Wonderful. Let me talk to you about the guys on the other side, not the community activists. Who was pushing those buttons? Was it the insurance companies and why?
So the Tea Party rebellion was being pushed by the Republican Party and by the insurance companies both. It wasn't just spontaneous. In fact, I've got a great quote in the book from Senator Jim DeMint, who's a Tea Party senator, who said in July, if we can kill this, if we can be sure this thing doesn't pass in July, there's going to be a big rebellion. So Republican operatives financed Tea Party, organized a lot of the actions. Not that the people doing it weren't really motivated. I don't want to say they were all. They were really motivated, but they were ginned up by the death penalized by Fox News. They were financed by Republican operatives. But so did the insurance company. In the book on the website, you can see a document. You can see a letter that United Health wrote to all its employees telling them to go and turn out at these town hearings with the Tea Parties. So that between the insurance industry and the Republicans and Fox News, that's what ginned up all this opposition.
Now, what were the stakes for the insurance companies? What did they have to lose?
Well, the interesting thing is for a long time, they were supporting the legislation because they would get a lot of new customers from it. But then they made a decision.
Why would they get a lot of new customers?
Well, they get a lot of new customers because all these new people would have health insurance.
And they would go to the exchange.
And through the healthcare exchanges.
Where they could buy their stuff.
Right. And so for a long time, they were supporting it. But they didn't want it to be highly regulated. And they wanted this individual mandate to have really, really high penalties so that people would really be onerous to buy it.
And I'm sorry, you got to explain that a little
again,
bit.
So in other words, if you didn't buy the insurance company wanted you to have to pay really high penalties for failing to buy it because they wanted to be sure everyone bought their products. So the insurance companies wanted no public option to compete with them, weak regulation, and a big penalty if you didn't buy their product. As the legislation moved forward, the public option stayed alive. They didn't know what was going to happen with that. We got stronger insurance regulation. And something that Chuck Schumer and Olympia Snow, the senator from Maine, did is they worried about the fines being too low. And they got them lowered too high. They worried the fines being too onerous, and they got them lowered.
What would be so bad about the fines being so high?
Well, because you don't want to put someone in a position where I really want health insurance, but I can't afford it. But then I have to pay this really high fine. I can't afford anything. That's really unfair to people. You want to have enough of a fine so it's an incentive to buy it, but not so much that people are just, you know, damned if they do, damned if they don't. So you really want to be sure that, so they were trying to be, and so what Chuck Schumer and Olympia Snow did is they had a more equitable fine, more along the lines of how it's worked in Massachusetts.
But let's go back, if we can, Richard Kirsch. And again, the book is Fighting for Our Health, the epic battle to make health care a right in the United States. And it's published by the Rockefeller Institute Press. So I want to go back to the insurance question. What do these guys make? Is it a humongous profit? What was at stake here for them?
They're very profitable. They're one of the more profitable industries. And they wanted to keep their profits, but not have a government competitor and not have regulation. And so what happened is they were supporting the legislation till the late summer, and then they decided to go after it. But it was too late because we'd built up such momentum, including actually beating the Tea Parties, which I'll talk about in a minute. But what they did is when they went out against it, they couldn't go out against it publicly because they're so unpopular. So all of a sudden, starting in September of 2009, we saw this huge ad campaign from the Chamber of Commerce against the healthcare bill. It was all, turns out, financed by the insurance industry. We thought it was financed by the insurance industry. We didn't have proof till months later. It turns out they laundered $86 million through the Chamber of Commerce to try to defeat the bill. They lost, and one reason they lost is they were too late. And they were too late because we had done so much organizing of people. And also, we made our whole theme in the fall, if the insurance companies win, you lose. It was our theme throughout the campaign. Anger against the insurance companies, organizing against the insurance companies. That's what kept us in the game.
Well, you say they lost, but they won the public option fight.
They won the public option fight. They still got a lot of new regulations, and they also still have a lower fines. But you know what? They're still winning. I mean, the thing about it, it's ironic here. They're really stupid, or maybe they're just laughing to the bank and they want it all. Probably they're not stupid. Their profits are up. They're doing very, very well. What they're worried about, though, is what we're starting to see in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is more aggressively controlling insurance company rates. Now, they're doing well in Massachusetts, too. But what Governor Patrick has been doing is leaning on the insurance companies. And he's doing that because since the state of Massachusetts now has to help pay for health care, it's very worried about costs. And we're starting to see a real move to control health insurance costs. Some people think that health insurance companies are going to change their whole model. They're going to change it to mostly covering big plans for big business and government where they're just the administrator, the same thing they do in Medicare. And most of them are going to get out of the regular health insurance market, which would be great because that would be a big opening for public health insurance.
So what percentage of our health care buck does the insurance company get?
I'm not sure what the percentage is overall. But when you write a policy, traditionally, 70 to 75% of that policy, 80% at the most, goes to healthcare and the rest of the insurance companies. And one thing the new law does is it changes that. It says health insurance companies have to spend 80 to 85% on healthcare, not on administrative or profit. So one of the good things in the new law is it's saying companies have to spend most 80, 85% of their money in healthcare. It's lowering their administrative costs. It's lowering their profits. That's another thing which is good in the law.
And how does that compare with what Medicare costs to administer?
So Medicare costs about 3% to administer. It's about 97% of healthcare costs. It's one of the big reasons that Medicare is better. The biggest reasons Medicare is better, though, which is very interesting, is that it pays less for healthcare. And, you know, you have a lot of doctors on the show and everything else. What people don't like to hear is that doctors and hospitals, not just drug companies and medical device manufacturers, but doctors and hospitals in this country are overpaid. They make a lot of money and they like to complain about it. Now, primary care doctors aren't overpaid. A lot of times they don't get paid enough. Specialists are still overpaid. They make a huge amount of money. The biggest difference between healthcare costs in the United States and other countries is that we pay a lot more in other countries. In other countries, if you're a doctor, you're doing it, you're going to be well paid, but you're not going to get rich. You're going to do it because you care about people. And hospitals are nonprofit institutions that aren't like the nonprofits here that have marble hallways and, you know, Chagall art in their walls. They're hospitals that are really spending money on providing good care. And oftentimes around the world, better care than here, because hospitals aren't competing against each other for the same thing. The government is saying we're going to have a center of excellence here. So we're under the illusion we have the best healthcare in this country. There's a lot of great healthcare in this country. There's a lot of waste, a lot of paying too much for too little, a lot of duplication. And another thing that Obamacare is starting to do is change that. It's starting to push the system towards what the real best healthcare in this country is, which is what Mayo Clinic does and Geisinger Clinic and others do and Cleveland Clinic, where doctors and hospitals work together. Doctors are usually on salary, and you get much better care. They're not out to make a buck. They're out to provide the best care. That's another direction that Obamacare is pushing the country. In the long run, that's going to mean better care at lower cost.
The book is Fighting for Our Health, the Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. Richard Kirsch, let me ask you this. The docs, you're mentioning the docs. When I first, I'm an older guy now, and when I first came up with studying political science and the politics of healthcare, which I did for my PhD, you know, the doctors and the American Medical Association hated all of this stuff. But that's changing, isn't it?
Yes. Historically, the AMA, the American Medical Association, was responsible for killing healthcare under FDR, for killing it under Truman. They tried to kill Medicare under LBJ and failed. Ronald Reagan was their big spokesperson. But that's changed. So one of the reasons it's changed is because what the doctors were worried about is that the government would have too much control over what was paid for health care and what happened. Now the doctors think the insurance companies have too much control. In fact, half doctors said, you know, we'd be open to some sort of government health insurance for everyone. So the fact that doctors are sick of insurance companies made them more open to basic reforms. And also, one thing you're starting to see is the new generation of doctors, not the doctors our age, but the doctors who are in their 30s and 40s, they actually have come into the profession much more concerned about quality of healthcare, not just to make a buck. And that's not totally true with all of them, but you're getting more and more of an ethos of, we actually realize it's immoral to work in a system that leaves 50 million people out. We want to have a system where everybody's covered. And that's a wonderful change to see in the medical profession.
I talk to many of them, and they say exactly that. And they're also not making that much money. I mean, a general practitioner in this country can now make somewhere between $100,000 and $150,000. That's not a lot of money.
No, as I said before, the general practitioners, the family docs, the pediatricians, they're making a reasonable amount. Unfortunately, still only a very small percentage. Harvard found to study 2% of medical students were going into primary care practice. Primary care doctors don't make too much. They could even make a little more. What we really need to do is, first of all, be sure they leave medical school with no medical debt, primary care doctors. Pay them somewhat more. If they paid a little bit more and no medical debt, you'd see a lot more doctors going into primary care. Instead, you go into specialty care, you make a ton more money, and you work shorter hours too. Because the other thing about a primary care doctor is you got to be on call all the time. And that's tiring if you want a family.
Richard Kirsch, let me ask you this. There are many people who come before these microphones who talk about the beauty of a public option. I happen to be supportive of that approach. What if Obama had insisted that there be a, you know, Medicare for all and lost? Would that not have made the agenda? Would his people not be more likely to come out, support him, fight like hell for him? Or was it just a matter of practical politics?
It would have been a disaster politically, actually. Because if he had come out for, you know, single-payer Medicare for all, people would have been like, the government wants to take our health insurance away. Obama wants to take our health insurance away and push everyone into government health insurance. It would have been a huge rebellion against him. And if he'd done it and lost, he would have failed and people would have still hated him. The right would have still demonized him. And you wouldn't have a situation where already millions of people are benefiting from their young kids getting, you know, young adults getting.
Those people are going to come out and vote for him?
Well, again, we're seeing in the polls that more and more his base is starting to turn around. And mostly that's because, though, of what he started to do in September. It's not so much because of health care, because after he finally woke up after this summer and realized he can't compromise with these guys, he realized he had no choice but to start being a progressive. He gave that great speech in Kansas, and his speeches since then for the American Jobs Act and his State of the Union. He's understood he's got to, in this election, distinguish between himself and, you know, Mitt Romney, who's going to be the, you know, the vulture capitalist, the guy.
Well,
from
how
Bain.
Can Romney, who invented Romney Care, get up on a debate platform with Barack Obama, who, by the way, is just a much better talker, and try to argue that Obamacare is bad and Romney Care is good?
Right, and he can't. And one of the reasons that, you know, Santorum says we can't nominate Romney, the Republicans, is because it takes away Romney Care and Obamacare as an issue. It does. It totally disappears because, as an issue, at least in the presidential debate. It doesn't mean Karov and company won't continue to try to demonize it at the congressional level. But what can Romney say? As I said before, all the president has to say to him, you should be proud of this, Mitt. It's great. And you're so giving into your right wing. Let's celebrate the fact that we actually both did something important here.
Let's talk about the concept of step one. There are those who want Medicare for all, who want some kind of unified health care plan, and who were saying sort of, you know, sotto voce, this could be the first step towards some kind of Medicare for all. Could it be?
The most important thing to understand about this is that for the first time, the government has a legal obligation to make health care affordable to people. One of the things that's really not understood in this country by people on the left who are big single-payer champions, they think everybody in the world is single-payer. That's totally wrong. In fact, only Canada has single-payer. What every other country has is what we just passed, which is a government obligation to make healthcare affordable. And what every other country does is they have a combination of some sort of system of either the government directly providing care or directly providing insurance or regulating private insurance. So in England, the government provides care. In Germany, it's all done through nonprofit private plans. All sorts of different ways of doing it. But in every one of them, the big thing is the government has an obligation to provide health care. And that's what the Affordable Care Act, that's what Obamacare has. So in some cases, in some ways, they're right when they say it's the first step. It's not going to be the first step to a pure Medicare for all. But over time, as everybody gets in the system, as this becomes part of the regular debate that Congress has about how to do it better, or the other side saying don't do it at all, it will improve. The same way Social Security improved. People forget when Social Security passed, it was a very limited program. First of all, it left out most of the professions that women and people of color had, teachers, nurses, farm workers. It was a very limited payment. It didn't increase inflation. There was no spousal coverage, no dependent coverage. It was weak. People said, oh, it's not worth doing, some people said. But over time, it improved and grew stronger. The same thing's going to be true with the Affordable Care Act, with Obamacare. Over time, we get through the Supreme Court. More importantly, we get through the election this year. It takes hold in 2014. It's here to stay. That's what the Republicans are scared of. And over time, it will lead to something that's not Medicare for all, but something between Medicare for all and Obamacare, something that really does meet our needs, that changes the way hospitals and doctors practice, that improves the quality of care. It'll be a struggle. These are always things that are a struggle. But it will fundamentally mean that for the first time in American history, you won't have to worry about being sick, could mean bankruptcy. You could die early because you don't have health care.
And if the five guys on the Supreme Court of the United States in black robes quash it, Richard Kirsch, you've given your life to this so far. You have a long way to go, of course, and you've got to be proud. But if they kill it, what happens then?
Well, first of all, they won't kill the whole thing. What they will potentially do is say that the requirement that everybody has to buy coverage if you can't afford it is not legal. It's not constitutional. That will throw it back to Congress. I mean, Congress could do nothing. And
well, this Congress will do nothing.
Right, right. So in 2013, Congress then will probably address it. What that looks like totally depends on who the president is and who controls Congress. There are fixes to it that would be pretty decent. For instance, you could automatically enroll everybody in health coverage who doesn't have it at work. And then it would be up to them to get out of it. That would pretty much do the same thing as the individual mandate because most people would get covered. You could change the rules that say, okay, you don't have to buy it, but if you decide you want to buy it later, you're going to have to pay a lot more for it. So there are ways around it. The individual mandate is only one way to do it. So if you have a Congress that's friendly to it, there are ways around it. Of course, if a Congress that's not friendly to it, or if a president that's not friendly to it, the whole thing's in danger because they could overturn the whole thing. I mean, and, you know, obviously, fighting for our health has been the fight of my life and the fight of a lot of people's lives, and it's a fight we're going to keep having pretty robustly through the election and then into Congress next year if it need be.
So, Richard Kirsch, you wrote this book, Fighting for Our Health. You've been a community organizer with Citizens Action for all of those years. What's next for you when we only have 2 minutes?
Well, right now I'm spending a lot of time on something called progressive economic narrative, which basically how do people who believe that we really want the government and the economy to work for the 99%, not the 1%, how do we tell our story? And particularly, how do we tell our story about how a strong economy doesn't happen by accident. It happens by decisions we make together to invest in people's lives, opportunity, education, to pave the way for businesses to innovate and be creative, to pave the way for businesses that do the right thing. It's like having good jobs in America, like safeguarding air and water. So we have to tell our story better. And so what I've been doing really since I finished writing the book, and I'm doing more and more, is how do we tell our story in a way that's resonant? And the Occupy movement was a great breakthrough, because they understand that the role of government and corporate power and inequality are all one story. And so I'm actually hopeful that in some ways what's happened in this country, this huge rise in inequality, the crushing of the middle class, the closing of the middle class, the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, the middle class disappearing, is opening up a new discussion in the country. And I'm trying to help that discussion go forward and hopefully do what I've always done, which is work for economic justice.
Well, Richard Kirsch, congratulations for what you've done up to now and what you're going to do. Our guest has been Richard Kirsch, an Institute Fellow at the Nelson Rockefeller Institute of Government and a Senior Fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Kirsch is the author of Fighting for Our Health, The Epic Battle to Make Health Care a Right in the United States. Thank you so much for joining us, Richard, and I'm sure you'll be back again to give us an update.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.